Hi, I'm Mike Dilke and you're listening to the Relax Back UK show, the show that explores all kinds of health topics relevant to you, your family and your friends. Each week I talk to expert guests from a range of backgrounds to inform and entertain you. So please do join the Relax Back UK family and stay tuned.
Hi, and thank you for joining me on the Relax Back UK show. The topic this week is back pain.
Modern life, you know, prolonged sitting, reduced movements and higher body weight and so on, just puts loads in the spine that it's not really evolved to handle every day.
Dr. David McKean gives reasons why you might get back pain, how to help it, getting a diagnosis, and one particular method to treat it called Intracept. Emma Fletcher was a back pain sufferer, and this treatment helped her greatly.
When he did say he had to get the bigger hammer out because my bone was too strong. So, but I didn't feel any pain throughout and I didn't feel a thing. Afterwards, I was hardly in any pain after.
So please do stay tuned for a great show. Thank you. So my guests today are Dr. David McKean, an expert in helping people with back pain, and Emma Fletcher, an ex-back pain sufferer. My first question to them was, just how common is back pain and are we a bad design?
Well, back pain is extremely common. So it's one of the most common causes of chronic pain that anyone will have. I think the lifetime prevalence for low back pain in the UK is about 60%.
So 60% of people will get back pain?
Yeah, at some point during their life.
Okay. Right.
But at any one time, about one in six patients or people in the UK will have back pain at any time.
Right.
So extremely common. And although that said, I wouldn't say that we're necessarily badly designed. It's just that the human spine's, you know, excellent for things like upright walking and load bearing, but modern life, you know, prolonged sitting, reduced movements and higher body weight and so on, just puts loads in the spine that it's not really evolved to handle every day.
Right.
Very common cause of pain, but not necessarily a bad design, but the way that we live nowadays does put a lot of stress on everyone's spine.
How about you, Emma? Were you just kind of unlucky in your back health, or did you fall off a horse or something?
No, I was just slightly unlucky, actually. I'm very fit, always have been. Gymnast from a young age, and you know, I've been fit all through my life. And I think a lot of mine has come through maybe a bit of wear and tear, maybe overuse. Mm-hmm. but I think a lot of mine stemmed from sitting too much. You know, my day job, I sit a lot in front of my laptop all day. And then in my sort of my other job in the evenings and weekends, I'm a personal trainer and fitness instructor. So I've got the benefit of the two, but I found sitting a lot really made my back uncomfortable.
Right.
And I think that had contributed to a lot of the pain as well that I suffered with.
Is that something you hear a lot of your patients saying?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, back pains covers a very broad range of different things. So there's lots of different potential causes for back pain. But yes, you know, a sedentary lifestyle, sitting for a long time, can certainly contribute.
Yeah.
You know, Emma's very fit, so it wasn't excess body weight or anything like that in her case. But I think, you know, doing gymnastics and putting all that load through your spine can also cause wear and tear, and that can contribute to patients' risk of back pain as well.
Actually, you might have partially addressed this already, but I was thinking, like, if it is so common, you know, why is it so hard to treat and so hard to find out what the problem is? Surely you guys have been trying to answer this question for the last 200 years at least.
Well, part of the issue is that there's so many different causes for back pain. So your spine's a very complicated bit of your body. There's lots of things that can potentially cause pain.
I'll admit, I did a bit of Googling before we chatted. I just put in a list of the kind of reasons why you might get a back pain. There were at least 50 that just came up. So
yeah, exactly. So there's a huge number of different things. And in the vast majority of cases, it's going to be what we call non-specific, and often just some muscle spasm, something that will often settle with time. Mm-hmm. But there's also going to be subsets of patients who have issues that will go on to cause them chronic pain for many, many years. So you can have issues with the muscles and the paraspinal muscles around the spine. You can visit issues with your facet joints, the joints at the back of the spine. You can have degeneration of the invertebral discs. You can have what we're going to talk about, I suppose, vertebrogenic back pain, where you're getting changes within the end plates, within the bones, within the spine itself. And then there's all the other causes, so fractures, sometimes infection, sometimes tumor. So a huge range of different things, from things that are very benign and will get better by themselves quite quickly, all the way through to things that will cause chronic pain for many years, and occasionally things that require urgent treatment. So it's a real minefield for doctors trying to make the diagnosis
I was going to
as
say, is
quickly as
that why
possible.
patients often seem to take, well, potentially years to get a
Yeah.
diagnosis? It's because it's very complicated and it's not easy.
I think that's part of it, absolutely. I think also we've historically in the UK perhaps not always investigated back pain as quickly as we could. A lot of people will go to their GP and be told, everyone gets back pain, do some exercise, have some physio, and best of luck. And while that works in many cases, there's also patients who actually need more investigations, essentially MRI scans and so on, to help diagnose the underlying cause of pain. And accessing that hasn't always been very straightforward. And I think what we need is essentially to find better ways to triage patients and create the pathways so those patients can access the tests that they need to identify the cause of their symptoms.
All right. Well, we'll come on to potential cures and et
Yes.
cetera in a moment. But before that, I've got what is essentially really quite an unfair question, but I'm going to ask it anyway.
Sure.
And it's more of an economics type question.
Yeah.
With one in six people having back pain at any one time, 60% of us having it at some point in our lifetime. Has anyone tried to quantify how much this costs, GB UK, from days off for sick, from NHS time, all this kind of stuff? Because I'm thinking it must be billions.
Absolutely, it is billions. I mean, the cost of chronic low back pain, the impact it has is absolutely enormous. So I think that there was a recent report from the Health Foundation that said that the impact of chronic pain, which is very broad, but a lot of those patients will be chronic low back pain, is up to £50 billion annually to the UK economy. So it has a huge impact. More specifically for back pain, the primary care healthcare costs alone are estimated to be between, £3 to £3.5 billion annually. And that doesn't count all the other economic costs for, lost productivity, sickness, absence, the disability benefits, and so on.
Less
So,
tax paid if people aren't working.
exactly. And then there's all the, the costs that are very difficult to measure. People may be at work, but far less productive than they would be normally because of the chronic pain that they're suffering. So yes, chronic back pain has a huge impact on UK economy and productivity generally.
Let's bring Emma in for a moment as well, because I'm thinking if you are suffering from, well, any pain, but we're talking about back pain here, and it's going on for months or years, and it's difficult to get a diagnosis. I mean, this is just going to weigh you down. This is going to be, for most people, not great for mental health and kind of family issues, relationships. It can affect, I imagine, a lot of different parts of your life. I mean, were you lucky, or is that your experience?
It was, I mean, the pain I had the pain for about quite a while before I actually got to see David. Luckily see old David. And I suppose for me it was the fact, I mean, I do work at home a lot for my day job, but it was my work which was getting noticed. So people in my own, in my you know my team were, and my clients were noticing a difference in me. I did feel it myself, because I was trying to take painkillers and trying to do as much as I could to overcome the pain. But it was being noticed by others, and people were actually bringing it to me and asking me if I was okay, and because you didn't see it yourself. And it was like for the past sort of 18 months before I got the right treatment, I was in chronic pain. I tried not to take as much medication as possible because you try not to, and tried to help myself the best way with physiotherapy and other things. But you know, it has a massive effect on everything, you know, from your day job to not being able to do the things that you love doing, because you just can't move as well, you know,
And I
and you're
suppose,
scared to move because you might damage yourself even more. So you're kind of like in
yeah, a
that kind of
vicious
loop.
circle.
Yeah, exactly.
In some ways, if you were suffering for 18 months, this might sound crazy, but actually, you might have been relatively lucky because, you hear stories of people that suffer for decades.
Gosh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I know of people who have suffered a lot longer than me, but you know, I was lucky enough to get into the system, and I was lucky enough for David to spot my MRI at the right time. It was all about timing, so you know, and it was good to actually get on to some of the treatment that's now available and the trial.
All right.
But the pain, yeah.
Let's move on to talking about treatments a little bit, because from my little Googling and from what you said, David,
Yeah.
potentially 50 different causes
Yeah.
for back pain. I'm quite sure there are hundreds of potential different treatments. So
Yes,
if,
yes.
if someone wakes up tomorrow morning, or if someone has back pain and it's been around for a number of weeks, what would you first thing suggest they do?
Well, the treatment is going to depend on, well, the right treatment is going to depend on identifying the cause of the back pain. And that's the key thing, really. In the vast majority of cases, as we were saying, it's going to be some muscle pain, which will often resolve by itself. But there are certain red flags you need to look out for. So if the pain is associated with a trauma and you're worried about a fracture, then you've got to go in. If you've got symptoms affecting your bladder or your bowel, so if you're losing control of your bladder or bowel, then that's often a sign that those nerves are being compressed and you've got to see somebody urgently. If you've got a fever or you're losing weight and you think that there's some other underlying condition, then again, seek help urgently. But if it's just back pain, then often patients, it can take quite a few months for patients to have tried conservative management and then start to potentially look for the potential underlying cause. I think in quite a lot of cases, imaging, things like MRI scans, are going to be very useful for identifying any potential structural causes for the patient's back pain. And again, the treatment then is going to depend on whether it's coming from, say, the facet joints, whether it's coming from things like pars defects, where you've got some small defects within the bone, or whether, as it was Emma's case, you've got vertebrogenic back pain, which is, I think, a relatively under-recognized cause of back pain. But we think that maybe one in six patients who have chronic back pain actually have this vertebrogenic back pain, which we can treat. And that's the key thing. It's something that we can potentially try to treat.
In the first instance, I'm thinking, well, trying things that are not invasive, like,
Yes,
a bit of
yes.
massage, a bit of physio,
Yes.
or go and see a chiropractor or an osteopath, these kind of things.
Yeah.
These do, or going for a walk around the block or something
Yeah.
like that,
Yeah.
has got to be the way to go, first off, hasn't it?
Absolutely, absolutely. So, moving, staying active are going to be really important, both for your back pain and for your general health. Keeping the muscles strong around your spine, your core muscles, those paraspinal muscles. Keeping those strong is really important for chronic low back pain because, in one way to think about it, is that if your core muscles are strong, that's actually taking some pressure off the spine. And staying active is actually helping the discs of the spine to stay hydrated. You're keeping the blood flow going, and so on. So, staying active is really important. But in some cases, the pain will persist and sometimes get worse. In those cases, you may want to pursue other investigations to identify what's causing that.
So other investigations, we're talking about a scan that you mentioned.
Well, exactly. Things like an MRI scan to that, for certainly for the back pain that Emma had, an MRI is absolutely crucial for identifying those patients. You couldn't pick those patients out without the scan. And with any treatment for back pain, actually getting the diagnosis right, getting the patient selection right, is crucial.
And is a scan like a a black, you get a black and white answer of, oh, that's definitely that, or is it a little bit more? I get the impression actually it's a bit of a black art.
Well, yes, I think that's very true. If you scanned everybody's spine, when we all get to a certain age, everyone's going to have some wear and tear in there. And in many cases, that's not going to be associated with patient pain. So the art is to correlate the patient symptoms with the scan findings and then to make a call as to where we think the problem's coming from. But you're right. In some cases, people can overinterpret the scan and point to a number of different things that are just signs of normal wear and tear, which will happen to us all as we get a bit older. That said, getting the diagnosis right is really crucial for the next part of the story, which is you're getting the right treatment. So yes, so imaging, very important. Don't overinterpret the scans. And my only other bit of advice is who reports your scan can be very important. There's a range of opinions out there, and you want a radiologist who knows what they're talking about to report your scan, I suppose, is the point I would make.
The station that makes you feel good.
What if your worst dreams aren't your enemy?
Falling, cheating, being chased, naked, drowning, losing teeth. What if I fail? What if something goes wrong?
I'm Teresa Chung, dream expert, best-selling author, and co-host of The Healing Power of Your Dreams. And in my latest title, Extreme Dreaming, I reveal a powerful truth. There are no bad dreams.
They feel so real, but that's so you remember them.
They're messages, signals, transformative gifts guiding you toward clarity.
Click on the Extreme Dreaming discount banner link on UK Health Radio homepage and learn to decode even your darkest dreams.
Extreme Dreaming.
Are you ready to listen?
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Okay, so are you saying there's like a bit of a postcode lottery or something going on here?
Potentially. I mean, I think that for things like vertebrogenic back pain, which is what Emma had, it's a diagnosis that not all radiologists, not all surgeons will even be aware of. Although this is something that we've known about for decades, I think, a relatively new concept, particularly in the UK. So yes, I suppose, a bit of a postcode
Okay.
lottery.
I mean, we can. There are lots of invasive techniques to deal with different issues. Now, you've mentioned this thing a couple of times, so let's just go into that. Vertebrogenic back pain. This is something that you can see on the MRI. What is it?
Sure. So it's vertebrogenic back pain is a particular type of back pain where the disc between the vertebral bodies is often a bit worn, and you get some irregularities and breakdown of the end plates, which are the tops and the bottoms of the vertebral bodies. And you get this reaction within the bones. And you get these very characteristic findings on the MRI scan, something that we call modic changes. And those are very strongly associated with low back pain. So this deep axial back pain, often worse when bending forward, worse when doing things like sneezing. This is a type of back pain that doesn't respond to standard sort of injections or anything like that, which usually target the posterior column of the spine. So those are the facet joints at the back of the spine. Right. This is a back pain that's coming from the front of the spine. And up until recently, I think most people would agree, was relatively hard to treat. And patients would often suffer with this type of pain for many, many, many years.
So was Emma a classic patient? Did Emma give
absolutely.
Diagnosis and classic problems? Yeah.
Exactly. So she had had some wear and tear of the disc, this inflammation within the bones. She had classic symptoms of pain, bending forward, and when she was, working as a personal trainer. And her MRI was, a classic MODIC 1 reactive end plate changes, where there's this very inflammatory-looking appearance to the bones.
Specific nerve, is it, that this particular wear and this modic change and this in this
yes.
part of the vertebrae catches on or causes
yes.
a problem with?
Exactly. So there's a nerve within the vertebral body called the basivertebral nerve that comes in through the posterior wall of the vertebral body, and it goes to the middle of the vertebral body, and then it arborizes up and down. So essentially it innervates the end plates.
Mm-hmm.
And if we could only find a way to deaden that nerve, or essentially sort of slightly suppress the signals going through that nerve, you can take away a lot of the pain that patients feel. And the team at Boston Scientific and Intercept developed a device that allowed us to do that. And that's what we were able to introduce last year.
Describe that advice a little bit, because I must admit, I looked at a video on their website. And it looks somewhat medieval. So describe it and what you do with it.
So it's actually a pretty straightforward procedure. What we do is the patient, as Emma will tell you, hopefully that it wasn't too barbaric, but the patient would be lying face down on the table in the interventional suite. And we use X-rays to guide a small needle that goes down into the vertebral body, and then we need to curve it round to specific points within the vertebral body where this nerve sits.
Okay.
And
was Emma awake at this point, or is it a GA, general anaesthetic?
It varies a little bit. Different hospitals will have different protocols. When we did it with just some conscious sedation. So Emma was awake and we could talk to her, but she wasn't, I think, in any pain. She was a bit sleepy.
Yeah, I'll ask her that later. Don't worry, David.
And we essentially tap this curved needle round to a specific point in the vertebral body. And then when we get to the nerve, we can
I'm just going
to
interrupt you there a little bit. The same video I was looking at.
Yeah.
You described it as tapping. The guy driving the machinery, I would say, was whacking.
Whacking. Well, there can be a little bit of whacking depending on how dense the patient's bone is. And I hope Emma doesn't mind me saying, Emma's bone was very hard. I think because she's an athlete and a personal trainer and has obviously put lots of load through her spine, and she's also young, so no history of osteoporosis or anything like that. So her bone was strong. And so there was a bit
of
whacking.
Was it Emma in the video? I couldn't tell from the shot. I'm assuming not.
It might. I don't know, actually. I don't know. There was a photographer there when we treated Emma, so
okay.
It might have been. Who knows?
That might be too much info. Sorry. Carry on.
But yes, so you're right. We do have to use a little hammer to sort of tap this device down into the bone. But once it's in the right position, we then put a small probe down into the channel that we've created.
Yeah.
And then we heat that up, something called radiofrequency ablation. So we heat up the nerve to lesion the nerve, which will essentially stop those pain signals coming from the bone. And it can significantly improve patients' pain.
All right. How hot is this getting?
Pretty hot. Hot enough to kill the nerve, so over 70 degrees. Anything over 50 degrees, you're going to get denaturing of the proteins in the cells and cell death, but about 70 degrees is sufficient to deaden the nerve.
And how is that heat got there? Is that electrical or some fancy gas expanding or
it's contracting? It's something called radio frequency ablation. So it's sort of electrical, I suppose, and you're generating this ablation zone, which is maybe about a centimetre or so in size.
Okay.
And that's sufficient to ablate the nerve within within the bone and take away the patient's pain. And my sort of route into this technique was actually doing something similar, but for patients with cancer in the spine. So the pain from cancer in the spine can be very, very severe and very hard to treat. But
yeah.
we knew for many years that essentially if you use this technique, this ablation technique, to ablate the cancer in the spine, the patient's pain got significantly better because essentially you were killing the nerve which was supplying the bone. And this is a similar idea, but much more targeted. So rather than ablating the entirety of the bone, you're just ablating a small part where this nerve is sitting.
All right. So you're stopping the nerve working. Now,
yes.
Like the nerve is going to be there for a reason, doing something fairly special, I would
yeah.
imagine.
Yeah.
Is it always a good idea to turn nerves off? Because, you know, they're there for a reason. Or has the nerve gone wrong? Is that what's causing the problem?
In this case, the pain that the patients are suffering is disproportionate to the underlying wear and tear. And that's why we want to try and deaden this nerve a bit. It's not that the patient will become completely insensate at that level. There are other nerves supplying the spine. It's something called the sinovertebral nerve, which is going to be in, sort of also supplying the area. So we're not taking away every nerve. We're just taking away the nerve that's carrying the majority of the pain signal. This has been a treatment available in the US for about a decade now. And mm-hmm. they've had long-term follow-up for patients, you know, for 7-10 years in some cases, and it's very well tolerated. So we haven't seen cases where patients are developing complications from the nerve being ablated.
Okay.
And the fantastic thing about this technique is that one alternative would be to do a spinal fusion, where you actually fuse the bones together to stop them moving.
Yeah. An ex-gymnast is not going to like that, I'm assuming.
Exactly. But creating a very stiff segment, a stiff block in your spine, often puts increased wear and tear, increased stress at the levels of above and below
right.
that fusion.
Yep.
And can actually lead to accelerated degeneration on either
That's
side
right.
of the fusion. Exactly. So with this technique, we're preserving your anatomy. And we're not damaging anything else. We're just deadening the nerve. And I think long-term, that's probably going to be a better option.
Right, David, we've had the theory. Let's
yep.
have the practice, what actually happened. So, Emma, how you went in one morning, had the thing done at lunchtime, and were home by tea time? Or was it, I'm joking, was it a bit more, how
no,
long were you
really
in hospital?
Quick. Really quick. I was literally in for the day.
You were so, here for the day? Okay.
Yeah, in and out in no time.
And how long were you on the slab for?
Not
the
long,
table?
I don't think. I can't quite remember. I was a bit out of it, but very long, it didn't feel like.
It took us an hour.
An hour,
so,
okay.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, but it went very smoothly.
Yeah.
And as far, I mean, I'm sure it wasn't a joyous hour, but as far as the levels of discomfort, tell us about that, but more about the discomfort when you're recovering from the thing.
Okay, so during, I didn't feel a thing. I was heavily sedated. Every time I kept coming around, I kept just having this kind of, it was a very weird sensation of something pushing.
Yeah,
not quite sure what
I
was going on.
That was David using the hammer.
Yeah, it was. When he did say he had to get the bigger hammer out because my bone was too,
okay,
too strong. So, but I didn't feel any pain throughout and I didn't feel a thing. Afterwards, I was hardly in any pain after, to be fair. I literally a couple of paracetamols and that was about it. I wasn't really,
okay.
I thought I would be in more pain than I was, but I wasn't. And it just got better. There were, you know, I went home, chilled out for a few days. Tried to chill out because I'm.
So were you walking the next day? Were you walking
walked,
that day?
I walked out of there.
You walked out. Okay.
Yeah, you walked out. Yeah, I walked out. Just obviously with someone walking with me. I didn't drive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But yeah, I walked out. Not hardly any pain at all. So it was a fantastic procedure.
Okay. And then, so how long until you like the how long did the after effects of the procedure procedure carry on for, like a week or two or a couple of months, or, you know, how long?
Not long at all. I found that within 24 hours, my pain level had dropped completely.
Okay.
Not completely at all, but, you know, it dropped quite dramatically from what it was because it was mm-hmm. chronic.
Yeah.
And then it just got better and better over the days. I mean, right. I was out walking a little bit the next day, not too much. And I was most probably walking, you know, a good 3 or 4K. Maybe I wasn't supposed to, but I was, slipped very gently, you know, by the end of the week, you know, just gentle walking with hardly, you know, with a pain level that was, say, a 9 down to about 3, you know, so, and it just got better and better.
And how long ago did you have this done now, Emma?
A year ago. It was about a year ago, wasn't it? Yeah.
And so where are you now? So are you back to your old self? Or?
Yes. Yes, back to my old self. I can back bend. I can forward bend.
Oh, really? So you're doing gymnastics?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I'm back. I can do all that now. So, and I can do Goodness. All the things that I was doing before the pain started, the chronic pain started, which is fabulous.
Yeah. All right. So, I mean, that is a success story, I would say, David.
Yes.
Yeah.
But tell me, are there, you know, what... I like data on this show. I'm assuming there are peer-reviewed published papers before you're allowed to sort of do
Absolutely.
It on patients.
Yes.
So give us some statistics of how many patients have had the procedure done and how many have been followed through successfully for a number of years, that sort of thing.
So one of the advantages that we have is that this technique's been around in the US for about 10 years. So we've got loads of data and it's very robust data that's come out over the last few years. And the success rates for this treatment are really pretty excellent. About a third of patients will get a 100% reduction in their pain, which is fantastic. About... 3/4 of patients will get an over 50% reduction in their pain. So that includes the 100%. But about...
I was just starting to
three quarters
numbers
yeah.
down. I thought,
yeah,
hang on a
yeah,
moment.
Yeah, so three quarters will get an over 50% reduction in their pain. So from about 8 to 4 or something like that, mm-hmm. Or better. But that just still does mean that there's about a quarter of patients who get a less than 50% reduction in their pain score. So it works very well. It doesn't work for everyone, but mm-hmm. it does work well. Now, there's a number of other things. If you respond, the pain relief seems to be very long-lasting. So they follow patients up to 7 years after this treatment. And if you've responded, that response seems to be sustained up to, you know, many years post-treatment. And we think that that's because if you ablate this nerve successfully and it's the cause of your pain, it doesn't come, the nerve doesn't grow back, and so the pain's gone potentially forever. So if it works, it works for a very long time. Now, there's always small risks of complications with any procedure, but the complications that have been reported with this technique are really, really pretty minor. A small number of patients will get a bit of irritation of one of the nerves going down their leg after the procedure, something called radiculopathy. And if that were to happen, we would give someone a steroid injection to try and calm that down. Although I've actually never had a case of that. And I think there's been a couple of cases where people have had some bleeding after the procedure. And both of those complications are really related to the technique of getting down into the bone. If you're essentially a little bit too lateral, then you can cause some bleeding. If you're a bit too medial, you can cause irritation of the nerve. But if you're just in the right place, then both of those complications are vanishingly unlikely.
How large is the target?
The target. So the pedicle, it depends which bone you're going down, but the pedicle, which is the bit of the bone we're trying to put the needle through, is going to be maybe 6 or 7 millimeters wide, maybe 8 millimeters wide. So it's a narrow little channel you're trying to direct your needle down. And then the nerve itself is a small nerve. So it's the target's maybe less than a centimeter within the middle of the vertebral body. And that's another point I would definitely make, Mike, which is that as with any targeted treatment, the key is to ablate the right bit of the bone. So if you put your ablation probe into the wrong place, somewhere else in the vertebral body, this won't work. You've got to be precise in how you do this. But in the right patients with the right technique, this can work very well.
Excellent. So tell me how this is available, because actually, this is not approved by NICE, is it? I don't think.
Not yet. So myself and some other practitioners have written to NICE asking them to go through the start the process of considering vas-vertebral nerve ablation for this particular type of chronic low back pain. And I anticipate that they will do that in the next year or so. In the meantime, you're right, it's not straightforward to access because NHS funding and so on. In our trust, we've actually been enrolled in a trial called the IMPROVE study, which essentially means that we're able to treat patients through this research project. But it's not available widely in the UK yet, certainly not in the NHS. It is available at some private hospitals.
Okay, all right. And presumably, from what you've described, it sounds like it's very cost effective. I mean, there's no overnight stay. You go in for the day, all goes well, you go home and you get better in a couple of days. So for the right person, this does sound like a very cost effective type treatment. So, maybe NICE will approve it.
I hope so. I think I feel pretty confident that they will because it's a one-off treatment, can have a huge impact on patients' pain, quality of life, productivity, all the economic benefits of that down the line. It's safe. There's 10 years plus worth of data to support its use. So I would expect. I would hope that NICE would look favorably on this, and I expect that they will approve this in the next few years.
So if people are currently suffering from back pain, which is proving hard to diagnose, and they'd like to find out a little more about this because they might be one of the patients that this could help for. How, what's a good source to get a little bit more information just to find out a bit more? I don't mean for doctors, I mean for regular people.
Yes, well, actually, there's a few good resources out there. There's a page on the internet from Boston Scientific talking about chronic pain treatment options and specifically the Intracept device, which is the name for this treatment for vas-vertebral nerve ablation. And that's got lots of information on the success rates, the data, the device itself. And so that would, I think, give you a lot of information about this type of back pain and the potential treatment options.
Excellent.
And then you might have to search a little bit harder to find radiologists or pain physicians who are able to offer this in the UK at the moment. I think that the number of people offering this will increase over the next few years, certainly. At the minute, there's a relatively small number of people offering this in the UK, but people can probably hunt them down on the internet if they look for vas-vertebral nerve ablation.
Good. All right. Thank you, both of you, for coming to chat about this. I think this is interesting. It certainly helped Emma greatly. That's obvious, and potentially can help many more people. So many thanks.
Sure. Thanks, Mike.
Thank you.
Thank you very much to my guests on this week's show. They were Dr. David McKean and Emma Fletcher, ex-back pain sufferer. The topic was back pain, in particular the Intracept system of curing back pain. If you are a back pain sufferer and you suffer when sitting at your desk, do take a look at my website, relaxbackuk.com, where you can see the back app chair, which has helped many hundreds of people who suffer pain when sitting at their desk. It can exercise your core muscles very gently when you're sitting down. You can apply to try out a back app chair. The website again is relaxbackuk.com. Many thanks.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
What if your healing journey could feel empowering, hopeful, even transformative? Welcome to the Alkaline Collective Mastermind, a community for anyone facing cancer, staying cancer-free, or committed to prevention. No matter your stage, whether you've chosen conventional care, an integrative path, or a fully holistic approach, here, you're not alone. Here, your healing journey becomes a journey of empowerment. We explore the science of oxygenation, metabolism, and alkalinity, while strengthening your emotional, spiritual, and physical well-being. This is a mastermind with heart, accountability, connection, wisdom, and real support. Because your journey isn't just about surviving. It's about thriving. Join us by clicking on the Alkaline Collective Mastermind banner on the UK Health Radio homepage or directly at alkaline-collective.com, where self-belief grows, healing deepens, and transformation begins.
Somewhere on Earth, there are 4 acres that belong to you. You don't need to be there in person, only there in purpose, protecting it, defending it, keeping it alive. Because the world doesn't need more good intentions. It needs more meaningful actions. Register your interest at 4acresearth.com.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Thanks for listening to the Relax Back UK show. Join me, Mike Dilk, again next week for more fascinating interviews and chat. If you're listening to the podcast version, please subscribe, like, and share it with your family and friends. And have a healthy week. Until next week.